Civil Rights and the Disabled, a report from the Department of Justice by Vanita Gupta. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Vanita Gupta delivering the keynote address at the 2015 Jacobus Ten Broeck Law Symposium. From the editor, the Jacobus Ten Broeck Law Symposium brings together leading disability rights advocates from around the country, and among the speakers at this year's symposium was Acting Assistant Attorney General Vanita Gupta. She delivered the keynote address on March 26, and here's what she had to say.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you for having me. Just from being here for the last 20 minutes, I just love the energy and sense of community in this room. It's clearly a very important conference, and I'm really honored to be here amidst such committed, smart, and creative advocates. So I'm relatively new to the Civil Rights Division. I've been here for about 5 months. I was just asking Eve how long I get to continue to say that, but I guess things are all relative. But really, at the Civil Rights Division, we at the Civil Rights Division, and I in particular, am really honored to be your partner in the ongoing fight for the civil rights for people with disabilities. The division is incredibly energized to do disability rights work, and it is one of my highest priorities for the division right now. I would say that every part of the Civil Rights Division is doing disability rights work, every part, every section. And I am proud and honored to be here with some of the leaders in that work who I work alongside with at the division, Eve Hill, Rebecca Bond, a number of staff from our disability rights section. I understand there's a lawyer here from our special litigation section. These are issues that are really kind of top priorities for the Civil Rights Division. And this year, we're going to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the 40th anniversary of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And we've made a lot of progress since then. And I understand that some of the comments this morning may have been discouraging, but I actually think that there is, while we have a lot of work to do, there has been enormous progress made. That said, as President Obama once said, as long as we as a people still too easily succumb to casual discrimination or fear of the unfamiliar, we've still got a lot more work to do. And as you know, disability discrimination is alive and well in this world. We at the Civil Rights Division and you in this audience take on flat-out discrimination every day of the week. But we also take on more subtle forms of discrimination that have effects just as devastating as the more obvious and explicit forms of discrimination. And regardless of the form disability discrimination takes, it damages not just those who it directly affects, but really our entire community and society. As a community, we cannot afford not to include people with disabilities in every aspect of life. Some of the obvious examples of discrimination that we are still confronting include banks like Wells Fargo refusing to accept relay calls from deaf customers. DOJ's settlement required Wells Fargo Bank to adopt effective communication and non-discrimination policies and provide $16 million in monetary relief for customers nationwide. We recently reached a settlement with the Law School Admission Council to reform its testing accommodation policies and stop flagging LSAT scores of test takers with disabilities who get the accommodation of extra time. That settlement requires nearly $8 million in monetary relief as well as a $55,000 civil penalty. We settled with the Louisiana Bar to stop asking intrusive and unnecessary mental health questions on its bar application and to stop imposing conditional admission requirements on people with mental health conditions just because of their disabilities. And our barrier-free healthcare initiative continues to find doctors, hospitals, and other healthcare facilities that discriminate against people with disabilities, whether refusing to provide sign language interpreters, not offering accessible facilities, or denying service to people with HIV. We've reached 7 agreements with healthcare facilities just this year to address those issues. Some more subtle examples of discrimination happen in some of the most important aspects of life: parenting, the internet, education, criminal justice, community living, and employment. I'm going to start with parenting. Parenting has frequently been found by courts to be a fundamental right, and yet a report by a National Council on Disability recently noted significant overrepresentation of parents with disabilities in state child welfare systems and concluded that the overrepresentation was due to bias. We recently saw such bias in the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families decision to remove a two-day-old infant from a mother who has an intellectual disability. Although DCF's policies support reunification, and DCF had a number of services available to help with reunification, DCF didn't offer the family all of the services it offered to other families. It didn't accept that the child's grandparents wanted to take guardianship and help raise the child with their daughter at their home. It didn't consider that the mother was taking parenting classes and pursuing her high school diploma. And it didn't appear to consider it a serious possibility that the child could ever be returned to her mother, just because the mother had an intellectual disability. And DCF then moved to terminate the mother's parental rights. It's a heartbreaking case. We investigated, and together with the Department of Health and Human Services, found that DCF was violating the ADA and discriminating against the mother because of her disability. We demanded that they provide the reunification services available to all other parents, as well as any services needed as reasonable modifications and compensatory damages. And 2 weeks ago, after over 2 years of separation, the grandmother was awarded guardianship and the child was returned to her family. I wish I had photographs that we were circulating at the Civil Rights Division of the reunification. This is where the rubber hits the road with our work, and our discussions, obviously, with the state are continuing. The internet. As you know, the growing reliance on the internet and other technologies for access from everything from groceries to education to employment has a great potential to be the great equalizer for people with disabilities, but only if those technologies are built accessibly. The National Federation of the Blind, Disability Rights Advocates, Lainey Feingold, the National Association of the Deaf, and others in this room have been leaders in demanding accessibility of websites and other technologies from the very beginning, and we are proud to have joined in that work. We're addressing accessibility of technology and settlements with colleges like Louisiana Tech, which will now only buy instructional technology that's accessible. And with public accommodations like Peapod, the Peapod online grocery service, which will make its website accessible. We've also recently included reviews of state and local governments' websites in our Project Civic Access compliance review programs, requiring jurisdictions like Nueces County, Texas, to make their websites compliant with the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0. And in compliance reviews of public entities' hiring practices, we've asked them to stop asking pre-employment questions about disability in their online job applications and require them to make these online applications accessible with WCAG 2.0. Education. We know we have a lot of work to do in education, and we are committed to working with all of you in this room on these issues. Just by one example, though, we recently reached agreement with Quinnipiac University for placing a student on mandatory medical leave after she considered suicide without considering other ways of accommodating her education while she sought treatment, such as allowing her to take classes in person or online or live off campus. Criminal justice. We're also transforming how police departments and prisons deal with people with disabilities. You've probably heard a lot in the news lately about the police response to young black men, racial profiling, and excessive use of force. We do those cases, and we are committed to working with law enforcement to rebuild the trust that is eroded in too many communities around the country. But what you may have heard less of is the police response to people with mental illness and other disabilities, or maybe you've actually heard plenty. It has been reported that in some jurisdictions, half of the shootings by police every year are of people with disabilities. I would urge you, for those of you who haven't seen it, to see the recent video that emerged out of Dallas of a schizophrenic individual who was killed within seconds of a call for assistance. We have to take these issues on. We have taken this issue on through our ADA enforcement because too often we have found that police that are coming in to help someone with mental illness find a person who is in crisis and simply can't follow law enforcement's directions. And too often, police officers do not have the training or the support to respond to people with mental illness. And as a result, officers are called in to help someone, may end up actually injuring, sometimes killing the person because of the tragic confluence of circumstances. So last year, we reached agreement with the Portland, Oregon Police Bureau to reform their response to people with mental illness. And we've already started to see really encouraging results. Just a month or so ago, according to the local Portland paper, police officer Zachary DeLong was called to a burglary report. He found a man on a ledge of a hotel about five stories up. He opened the window of the hotel, and here's what he said. "I peeked around the window, and he was right there, less than 12 inches away from my face," DeLong said. "It actually made me jump back a little bit." The man was crying and sobbing. "That's when DeLong's crisis intervention training kicked in," he said. "There was no crime being committed, and it was time for compassion." He began to speak calmly to the man, assuring him from the start that he was not in trouble. "I told him, we just want to help you out, but to do that, we need you to come inside." And the back and forth seemed to work. The man inched closer to open the window while DeLong repeatedly assured him that he and Hall were there to help. And slowly, the man moved closer to the open window until he was close enough to touch. Both officers reached out, each grabbing an arm, and pulled the man into the room through the window. "The rescue couldn't have lasted more than a minute or two," DeLong said. "But once inside, it became clear that the man was clearly in a mental health crisis and intoxicated." Paramedics from the Portland Fire Bureau were also in the room and later took the man to a hospital for mental health treatment. He was not charged with any crime. "He was at the point where he wouldn't have lasted very much longer on the ledge," DeLong said. And Hall and DeLong later learned that the man had crawled out on the narrow ledge on the building's west side and then sidestepped through his way about 100 feet to the building's south side. "It's scary to think about what could have happened," DeLong said. And just a year ago, that call may have ended very differently. Just a year ago, many calls in Portland, just like that, ended up with a person on the ledge injured or in jail or dead. But our settlement has helped prevent needless tragedies because it requires crisis intervention training that Officer DeLong relied on to successfully resolve this situation. But as all of you know, there are too many jails in this country that are housing far too many mentally ill individuals in need of treatment, not incarceration. In prisons, we've long challenged unconstitutional conditions of confinement. We've also recognized the importance of the ADA compliance in prisons and jails, particularly regarding the treatment of prisoners with mental health conditions and other disabilities. And so in Pennsylvania, we've issued a letter of findings identifying the state's use of solitary confinement and failure to provide treatment for people with serious mental health conditions as both unconstitutional and violative of the ADA. And we've challenged the overuse of solitary confinement on juveniles with disabilities in California and in Ohio. Last, I want to talk about community living. You may have heard about our Olmstead enforcement work. The DOJ is deeply committed to the civil rights principle of community inclusion for people with disabilities. The ADA requires state and local governments to provide services to people with disabilities in the most integrated setting appropriate for each person. Olmstead has been called the Brown versus Board of Education of the disability rights movement. It says separate isn't equal, and unnecessary segregation is discrimination. I'm proud to say that the Justice Department and disability advocates and lawyers across the country like you are transforming the paradigm of services that states provide to people with disabilities from one that assumed that people with disabilities were not capable of living in, benefiting from, and contributing to the outside community, and that assumed that it would be cheaper to serve everyone in one place. And because of those assumptions, state systems were set up so that people with disabilities had to go to an institution and be segregated and interact only with other people with disabilities, or they had to go without. But those assumptions about how best to serve people with disabilities are wrong. First, the cost assumption is wrong. Community-based services cost less than institutional ones. And we can serve just about everybody, no matter how complicated their needs in the community. Second, we know that people with disabilities benefit from community inclusion. Community involvement helps people with disabilities. It avoids helplessness, stimulates intellectual growth, develops social skills, and increases self-esteem. That shouldn't surprise any of us. A person learns to live in the community by living in the community. And we all need supports. We need friends, we need family, we need maps and Google. But we don't learn to live in the community by staying in one room. Integration of people with disabilities also helps the broader community. Community members learn to accept differences, improve communication skills, and learn from the diversity of experience of people with disabilities. And so through our Olmstead enforcement, we're transforming state service systems from ones that force people into institutions to ones that focus on services provided in a person's home, whether it's their family's home or their own home or a small group of roommates. And since 2009, we've reached transformative settlement agreements with the states of Georgia, Delaware, Virginia, New York, New Hampshire, and North Carolina. And under those agreements, the states must develop community-based services for people with mental health and developmental disabilities and transition people from institutions into the community. These agreements are helping more than about 46,000 people with disabilities re-enter or stay in their communities. At first, our Olmstead work really focused on where people live. But community integration doesn't end at the door of your apartment. The fact that a person sleeps in the community at night will not mean much if they spend their days in an institution. And so now we're applying the community integration lens or frame to other areas of life, including school, work, and day programs. Last year, we reached a settlement, an agreement with the state of Rhode Island to transform its employment and day services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities from ones that sent people to sheltered workshops to ones that support people with disabilities in real jobs with real wages. You can read about Stephen and Pedro and Louis, some of the people who have benefited from our Rhode Island settlement on our Faces of Olmstead page on ada.gov/Olmstead. Louis just completed his probation period at work. He earns far more than the minimum wage. He receives full benefits, and he's a union member. And you can read about Peter Maxmean on the front page of the Sunday New York Times from December 7th, 2014. That article tells how, since leaving the sheltered workshop, Peter found a good-paying job, he learned to drive, he got a license, he bought a car, he also got his first parking ticket, I understand. We couldn't help him with that one. And he got engaged and he got married. We at the Civil Rights Division understand, though, that our enforcement work alone can't change the world. For that reason, we're working with other agencies to address discrimination through guidance and coordination of federal programs. In November of 2014, together with the Department of Education, we released a Dear Colleague letter to public schools across the country explaining that effective communication requirements of the ADA are not subsumed within the special education requirements of the IDEA. That guidance made clear that in some instances, a school may need to provide auxiliary aids and services to ensure equally effective communication to a student with a disability that are not required under the IDEA. In our employment-related work, we are also working closely with other agencies. The Civil Rights Division is co-leading the Curb Cuts to the Middle Class Initiative, which is a group of 11 agencies working together to coordinate and leverage resources across the federal government to increase middle-class employment for people with significant disabilities. Already, the Curb Cuts Initiative has helped organize a White House Champions of Change event and a White House Summit on Employment with People with Disabilities. Over the next few months, the initiative will be developing online tools to help bring federal resources to job seekers with disabilities and the companies that want to hire them, implementing job-driven strategies to help people with disabilities develop the skills they need for today's and tomorrow's high-demand careers, and increasing collaborations among American job centers, educational institutions, labor unions, vocational rehabilitation agencies, veterans organizations, independent living centers, and others to offer a career path. We have some unprecedented opportunities right now before us to level the playing field for people with disabilities in all areas of life. But it will take all of us working together. There are great, great challenges ahead. But working with all of you, as well as with other federal agencies, service providers, the private sector, the Civil Rights Division stands ready to do its part to break down barriers faced by people with disabilities. Mother Teresa said, "I alone cannot change the world, but I can cast a stone across the waters to create many ripples." Now, I rarely encourage people to cast stones, but I look forward to creating ripples, even waves, maybe even a few tsunamis of equal opportunity with all of you. Thank you very much.
You want to take questions?